Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. When I was a geosciences major at the California State University at Chico, I took a lot of amazing classes, and one of my favorites was a course about the history of science. But one class I really wished I'd been able to take would be a course that explains how science really works, and the perfect textbook would have been the one written by today's guest, Dr. James Zimring. He's a teaching and research professor of pathology at the University of Virginia. His new book, What Science Is and How It Really Works, is an amazing tour of the so-called scientific method. And newsflash, there really isn't a simple version of it that you tend to see in high school science textbooks. Zimring's book is an in-depth look at how science actually does work at the professional level. But one thing I want you to know is while it is in-depth, it isn't boring, and it's filled with humor and insight. Dr. Zimring joined us recently from his home in Virginia for a wide-ranging conversation about the nature of science, and as Blue Dot's patron saint Carl Sagan put it, science is much more than a body of knowledge, it is a way of thinking. James Zimring, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, thanks for having me.
I feel like I should call you Dr. Jim.
You could do that, but I don't recommend it.
Does anybody call you that? Because you are a physician.
I am a physician. I don't see patients much. I'm a pathologist, so No, I don't get called doctor much, which is my preference, to be honest.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about your background in pathology. Explain to us what your specialty is.
Yeah, so pathology covers a lot of ground, but I study diseases of the blood, and in particular transfusion as a therapy. And when you transfuse blood in between people, their immune systems can respond to the donor blood and cause all kinds of problems. So I'm an immunologist who studies transfusion, and that's my main academic work.
And I was reading something about you, and we can get into this more later if you want, but I saw that the method you use was called bench to bed to bench. Could you explain what that means?
Bench to bedside and back is the phrase that's usually used. And the idea here is that when you're in the laboratory at the bench and you're kind of restricting the variables that might be present in order to isolate particular parts of what you're studying, you can make a lot of progress fairly quickly, but it's abstract and it's far away from the real world and certainly far away from patients. And so the goal is to discover things in the laboratory at the bench, bring them into the arena of patient care, and learn from that. And then from what you learn, go back to the bench and ask the next question. And so that's the ideal.
Well, let's talk about your book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. And before I say anything, if I were designing the curriculum, the pathway for a college science class, any kind of degree at all, I would recommend a class that had this as a textbook, as the basis for beginning any kind of career in science.
Wow. That makes me feel really good to hear you say, because regrettably, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any curriculum, maybe in the whole country, that really has that as its major component, if any component at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the big problem. And my sense is that's kind of why you wrote the book, right? What was your purpose for writing this?
That's exactly why I wrote the book, although it came from a weird source. My first year as faculty, this was back at Emory University, I was assigned a class to teach, as assistant professors often are, on methodologies in immunology. And when I started lecturing to the students, it became clear to me that what they really wanted to know was what are the philosophical underpinnings of knowledge claims in science, as opposed to the factual material that they had learned along the way. And I was a little bit shocked to learn that I couldn't teach it to them because no one had ever taught it to me. And so over about a decade of teaching that course, and you always learn more from your students than they do from you, I educated myself to this area and started getting into this space. And the more I learned, the more fascinating it became. But I became convinced that not only should we be teaching this to our students of science, but that a lack of understanding of the basis for scientific knowledge claims is a source of huge problem to the lay public, to the voting populace, to our legislators, pretty much across the board. And so that's what really motivated me to try to put this down in a digestible form.
And as I was thinking about talking to you about this, I'm wondering, what is your sense of for the scientific community, for all of the wonderful scientists that I'm friends with and interview and I've become very close with over the years? What is your sense of their understanding? These are some of the world's great scientists of how science actually works. Do you think that the majority of the scientific community really has a handle on all of this?
You know, I think the majority of the scientific community knows very precisely how to carry out scientific research. And they kind of take a Potter Stewart view of it, is that I know it when I see it. But if you ask them to articulate it in codified terms and in very clear building blocks and in logical form, respectfully to my colleagues, I think they would struggle and maybe struggle pretty badly. And the reason is, again, we learn how to do science largely through apprenticeship and doing, you know, a task over and over and over again. But the theory of what the basis of scientific knowledge claims are is never formally taught, at least seldom, I should say. Nothing is never. And when it is taught, it's probably not taught in a way that would be really useful to scientists. I mean, by analogy, you can be a great race car driver but have no understanding of the thermodynamics of how an internal combustion engine works. And I think that's where a lot of scientists find themselves today.
And I was thinking about this because a colleague of mine who's a science teacher was looking for some textbooks in a colleague's class. And I asked him, well, what are you doing? And so, well, I'm looking for a better explanation for the scientific method for my classes. And I started thinking about that. And I told him, I said, to tell you the truth, there really is no, you know, exact steps of a scientific method. The way that's taught in textbooks is kind of mythology. What's your take on that?
It's absolutely mythology, but the problem goes much deeper than this. When I first started learning this field, you know, it's very humbling and shocking at first because scientists study nature, but there are whole fields of scholars who study scientists. So it's like you're looking through the microscope one day and suddenly you kind of stretch your back and you look up and you realize you're at the bottom of someone else's microscope. And so when you look at the fields that study science, it's stunning some of the observations they make about scientists that scientists probably wouldn't have the insights to. But at the same time, the fields that study science are at a real disadvantage because when they analyze science, they look at the products of science, largely, which are scientific papers, scientific reports, the technologies that come forth from science. But how science is reported and how science is presented is not how science is done. And there are some very, very good reasons for that. But the philosophers of science and others have sort of tried to create this method based around what they read. And, you know, Winston Churchill once said that those who love the law and those who love sausages shouldn't watch them being made. And I think you could extend that to the practice of science. It is a mess. And after you've made your discoveries, you explain them in a logical way that makes sense to the reader, but that's not how it's done. And the method itself, and there never has been a single codified method, but there are principles and rules and general things upon which I think most scientists would agree, and that guides us. But there's no hard and fast crank you can turn and scientific knowledge comes out. Regrettably, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all of those elementary school teachers out there that, you know, have a science fair and they want the students to make a poster that's got, you know, first you make observations and then you make, you know, some ask a question and then you gather data and then you draw a conclusion and then, you know, what's your hypothesis? Like the step-by-step cookie cutter version of science. And from, you know, my vast experience with scientists who are friends and that I have talked to over the years, that's not really how it works at all. It's more of an investigation of nature and gathering data. And then where does the data take you? And you really get into that question of like the data, it really is the linchpin of science, isn't it?
Data, yes, it is the linchpin of science, but it's challenging here because data, which is, you know, another way of kind of saying experience, you know, but although under very particular circumstances, is the linchpin of a lot of approaches to understanding. Certainly, I think if you look at people who study history, people who study law and the adjudications of facts, people who have spiritual encounters in the woods or theologians who study religion, most of it is experience-based. So most of life is trying to reconcile what we believe with what we experience, and our reasoning gets all mixed up in there. And we try to make sense of it all and seek coherence and try to resolve contradiction. And science does that the same as all these other areas. But a key distinction here, and this is what a philosopher of science named Quine called a web of belief. And he coined this phrase well before the World Wide Web. This is the web of belief. And I think it's a really good analogy. But one way that you can distinguish science is that the rules for modifying the web of belief are very different. And when we use the term data, what we're saying is we're referring to experience, but only certain types of experience gathered in certain ways qualify as being valid in the scientific way of modifying the web of belief. Whereas, you know, just in life, experience is experience, and that's good enough. So I think that's a key distinction, that data is super important, but it's much more than data. If it was just data, there'd be no difference between a scientist and an encyclopedia.
Yeah, and I was thinking about, you know, like somebody that's a master chef or just a really good cook. You learn from your experiences, like what works, what doesn't work, and then over time, you develop those techniques that, you know, make you, you know, the kind of person that I want to sit down and eat your dinner.
Yeah, absolutely. And you learn the critical and the non-critical components. I mean, if you're making a sauce, you might put in 10 times too much oregano and maybe no one notices. You put in 10 times too much salt and no one can eat the stuff. So you got to learn the particulars. And there is a lot of intuition involved in science, but it's learned intuition. So really, it's based on experience, just as you said.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. James Zimring as we talk about the process of science and his new book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back to our visit with Dr. James Zimring. His new book is What Science Is and How It Really Works. Let's talk about some of the big questions, you know, confronting us today societally, and where science kind of collides with them, and we have some misunderstandings and frankly, problems it creates for us. Two big examples, and you wrote about these in an editorial you just recently wrote, I'm guessing for a local paper for you, the Daily Progress. Is that in Virginia?
Yeah, that's the local paper in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live.
Yeah, and it was really well written. But and you talk about these like two very big issues, and they keep coming up over and over again. And one is definitely in your wheelhouse, and that's this idea that somehow measles vaccinations cause autism. Let's talk about that for a moment. Give us your take on that, and how your understanding of science and this book kind of collides with that whole thing.
Gosh, this is a huge issue. It's so very important, not only because it reflects the problems we have in communicating between science and the lay public, but because it's an issue, you know, of life and death and health for a lot of people. Some years ago, the idea was forwarded that measles, the MMR vaccine in particular, may predispose children to autism. And I want to take a step back and say that the people who have made this observation and the parents who have seen this happening with their own kids are smart people, and they are really observing what they're observing. And we do a discredit to them, a deep discredit to them, throw out that conclusion without a very good reason for doing so. And the reason that they've made that observation is that, you know, most kids who first manifest autism do so around 2 years of age. That's when the developmental programs come online, when it becomes obvious, or not obvious, but when you see the signs of that happening. And according to the current pediatric guidelines, kids get the measles vaccine between 12 and 15 months of age. So if you're giving the measles vaccine to everyone, which at one time, you know, we largely were, then essentially every kid who gets autism, every one of them, was healthy until a few months before their symptoms, they got the measles vaccine. So this is an extremely strong association. Unfortunately, there were also some papers published out there that engaged in some scientific misconduct, but it doesn't matter. When this pattern was noticed, it's imperative that it is investigated and very carefully. Now, that's just an association, one thing happening after another. And lots of things happen right after each other. As some famous examples of some philosophers, you know, the night always comes after day, but it's not caused by day. And an example I give in the book is that, you know, you could easily conclude that gray hair causes death, because gray hair, you know, accumulates so much as people get older. And the reason that is correlated is because it's a confounder with time. And so the question on the measles and autism is one causing the other? Or is it simply that they're related in time and therefore they always come after one another? And so a large number of studies have been carried out by CDC and by other organizations testing predictions that would be the case if the measles vaccine caused autism. And so they looked at societies where some kids got the measles vaccine and some didn't, and there was no difference in the rates of autism. And they looked at societies before and after the measles vaccine was implemented, and there were no rates in autism. There's a preservative in the measles vaccine called thimerosal that a lot of people have been very suspicious of, and they looked at controlled situations with without thimerosal, and there was no difference in the rates there. And this is not some big conspiracy to hide things from people. These are the data. And so if the MMR caused autism, each of those things would have shown a difference. And so this is so critical, because as you're aware right now, we're hopefully at the tail end, but in the past year and a half of a huge measles outbreak. Measles is not a benign illness. When it infects people, it can cause all kinds of serious disease and death and permanent neurological problems. There are vulnerable people out there who cannot get the vaccine because they are immunosuppressed. In fact, little babies before 12 months of age can't get the vaccine at all. So when unvaccinated people spread the disease, it can injure so many people. And to not vaccinate individuals because you're afraid of an autism effect that certainly basically isn't there, causes huge amounts of harm. But back to the individual parents who observed their individual kids who were healthy, got the vaccine, and then got autism, they made a correct observation. And with a data set of one, there is nothing you will ever, well, I think it would be very hard to convince them otherwise, which is understandable from their point of view. And that's a big difference between a single individual's observation and a systemic scientific analysis of an issue.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's why science is such an important tool for our society in order to advance ourselves and to protect ourselves against things like this. You know, I was thinking about this when I read your book. It took me back to one of my favorite books from 1995 by Carl Sagan, who's the patron saint of this show, Blue Dot. He wrote a book called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. And there was a section in there where he gave this toolkit for thinking. And I'll always remember reading that. And as I think about your book, I think these two books would be just great on every bookshelf of every scientist or anyone who believes in scientific thinking. They're great companion books to each other. But in the toolkit, he talks about fallacies of logic. And what you're talking about is post hoc, ergo propter hoc. It happened after, in Latin, therefore it was caused by. And that causality mistake is exactly what you're talking about.
Absolutely. But it's essential to absolutely it's essential to remember that post hoc ergo propter hoc is a fallacy of logic. But just because something is fallacious doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. When one thing causes another, it does come before it, right? So yeah. When you observe two things happen in sequence, you can't tell whether one causes another. All you can tell is they happen in sequence. This was probably first and most famously put forth by David Hume, the famous Scottish philosopher, who pointed out that, you know, when you see a billiard ball hit another billiard ball and the second one moves, we say, well, the cue ball caused the eight ball to move. But we don't observe causality. We simply observe one thing happening after another. You might easily conclude that lightning causes thunder, right? Because we always see it, one happening before the other, but they don't. They're both caused by a common cause, electrical discharge, and it just so happens that lightning travels faster than sound, and so we always see it first. And so it's normal human thinking when you see things in events to assume causality. It's scientific thinking to test causality by isolation of variables and separating things, and that is a big disconnect between common sense thinking and scientific thinking, and I think it's a major source of miscommunication between scientific knowledge claims and what just makes sense to a lot of people.
Yeah, there's so many things in science that, you know, are counterintuitive. Like, for example, when Einstein's special theory of relativity first came out, where he basically makes the correct argument that there's no such thing as universal time. It's tied to the motion of objects. That, you know, the time that ticks for me is not necessarily the exact same time that ticks for you if you happen to be in motion relative to me. Those things are counterintuitive to people. It's like, it seems like time should just be time, but that's based on our human everyday understanding of how the world works and what you just called common sense. And so one of the things I really enjoyed about this book was how our evolution and our thinking processes, our psychology, which has helped us survive for thousands of years and thrive, also gets in our way to understand how things really work.
Absolutely. You know, we did not evolve in a laboratory isolating variables and trying to figure out these things. We evolved out in the world, and the thought processes that we evolved are the thought processes that helped us survive and reproduce at a higher rate than people who had other thought processes. And for those reasons, we are hardwired, if you will, to do what works, not what is true. And so in a lot of ways, scientific thinking is very similar to otherwise normal human thinking, but the key components are to unlearn things that we've spent an awful long time evolving in order to circumvent those problems that helped us survive, even if they led to what we currently see as the wrong answer. And that is a large part of graduate training, because it's awfully hard to unlearn these things. And sometimes, I'll tell you from personal experience, you never stop feeling that something ought to be the case, but intellectually you know that it isn't. And so this is a cognitive dissonance that I think most scientists probably feel throughout their careers at some level.
And another aspect of this is always been interesting to me is our memory, because our memory is so very fallible. What we think really happened, like I was watching a documentary recently, and they were talking about people that were had experienced 9/11 in New York City, and that their memories of that event when they actually found out about what happened were so different from reality. For example, one young woman who was in a school thought her mom was there in the city, and she was convinced that that's the way it happened. I was in school, my mom was here. And then her mom told her, you know, years later, it's like, no, I was in Connecticut. And she's like, what? So it's like, you know, this very dramatic event, you know, that you can't possibly forget. Like, you know, where you were when it happened and what that was like. And yet these people have these very flawed memories. And this kind of thing comes up in criminal trials all the time.
This is a huge problem. I have to say, of just the human condition. Regrettably, it's when you look at the data out there on memory, you have to reflect upon the fact that your formative memories of things that happened to you, good or bad, in many cases probably didn't happen the way you remember them, and they may not have happened at all. And that's striking. I mean, if our only sense of self, our life narrative, is, you know, our memories of what happened, what is that? What are the philosophical implications of that? But the data are awfully hard to argue with. You can, through a series of maneuvers, implant memories in people. You can change memories in people, and people do it to themselves, because every time you remember something, you reconstruct it in your mind in the context of all the things you've learned since you last remembered it. And so, you know, you show a kid a picture of themselves when they were two, and then you tell them a story about it. Well, they don't remember being two, but they see the picture. And then the next time you tell them, they remember having seen the picture. And that then becomes, you know, a memory. And then the next time, even more and more, and eventually they can lose the distinction between, do they actually remember it, or do they remember seeing the picture? And this is a problem. You know, Louis Pasteur had a rule in his laboratory that if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen. He had lab meetings, and someone said, oh, yeah, I did that experiment 6 months ago, and I remember this and this. And no, because he was very much aware of this issue. This is a big problem, not just in science, but as you said, in our criminal justice system. You have a single event occur, and six people saw it. And you even stipulate they might have seen it from the same vantage point. They all remember it differently. They can't all be right. It's possible they're all wrong. It's problematic because, yeah, I mean, how do we process experience if we can't trust our own recollection of it?
Well, let's take a look at another big societal issue where there's been a lot of conflict, and that's climate change. It seems to people like me, you know, that this is a no-brainer. You know, the physics of climate change isn't really that complicated. When you pump that much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and they are absorbing the infrared radiation that the Earth gives off at night and basically trapping it more and more, and we're putting more and more in, there's a consequence to that, and it's a warming planet. And yet, you know, this has become somehow controversial. Just the other day, I was talking to a very educated, smart, professional person and brought up the fact that, you know, most of the world scientists, you know, are in agreement about the level of our contribution to this change that we're seeing that's affecting our planet and how dramatic it is. And yet he, you know, said, well, there are scientists, though, that think the other side, too, you know, so you should listen to them also. And I was like, it just, what? You know, that made no sense to me.
You know, this is a really tough issue. On the one hand, the comment is right that if someone has an alternate theory, explanation or whatnot, we should listen to them, of course, and we should evaluate their claims based upon data and reason and our best ability to determine them. But this gets back to an earlier part of our conversation, one of the great harms that is done in a misunderstanding of science. You know, the P word, the prove word. In my laboratory, if anyone says prove, I'm going to prove this, they have to sit in the, you know, the timeout corner for one experiment, because there is no proof, not in a logical, mathematical, absolute way. There is no amount of data or thinking that can't be altered by introducing new things that you may not have thought of, or things that we are confused about. And I can give, you know, example after example after example. And whoever waits for absolute consensus waits forever, period. Regrettably, this has been used as a disingenuous attempt to manipulate the populace by those who don't like the conclusions that the vast majority of scientists would come to, by pointing to the one outlier, by pointing to the one paper, the one individual that says otherwise. They say, well, scientists disagree. It's not proven. It's not known. We should wait longer. And, you know, there's a fantastic a book on this topic called The Merchants of Doubt that talks about how the tobacco industry did this for decades. Well, yeah, it might cause cancer, but it hasn't been proven yet. Well, for a number of reasons, tobacco's link to cancer will never be proven. But at some point, the amount of evidence accumulates to a level that you simply have to say that this is an overwhelming argument, even though it doesn't rise to an absolute logical proof. And I should also say that what's causing global warming is another level of argument, as opposed to, is the Earth getting warmer? And here you get into another issue of people warping or cherry-picking data, when actually all you got to be able to do is read a thermometer, and it's kind of hard to miss.
Yeah, and just it's like the amount of evidence and data is just so overwhelming. It's like you have to. I just got a climate report for Northern California for the summer, showing, you know, how the climate has warmed indisputably. The overnight lows are getting warmer. These are much warmer temperatures, and yet, you know, people say, well, actually, it seemed like a pretty cool summer to me, just because there weren't an extended period of days over 110 that they've experienced in the past. They mistake that for like the overall trend of the temperature over time averages.
Well, this gets back to your earlier point about natural human thinking versus that we evolved versus scientific thinking. When we were evolving, you know, wandering around the savannah or whatnot, we have single experiences. We're storytelling creatures. We share our single experiences with each other, and we make determinations about them. We never evolved in a context where we would have large amounts of data over different statistical distributions, and we had to figure them out. So single instances are very compelling for us. I may say to you, well, smoking increases your likelihood of dying from lung cancer. And you say, well, my grandfather smoked, you know, 40 packs of cigarettes for, four packs a day for 10 years. And he didn't die of lung cancer. And to you, that's a pretty compelling counter instance. But I never said, if you smoke, you will die of lung cancer. I said, on average, smoking increases your likelihood of lung cancer. And so this, again, with global warming, yeah, you know, no matter how much the Earth is getting warmer, there's going to be cool days. And senators will walk into the well of the Congress with a snowball, and they'll laugh about how ridiculous global warming is. But to look at a single data point out of an average over time is to really miss the whole issue.
Also, just to look at it from your particular place on the planet at a given point of time, instead of the entire planet over a longer period of time, that's where I see people have just real misunderstandings, because, you know, they live in their own small town or city or wherever, and they're just noticing, you know, what happened to them on a given day, not really looking at, well, what's going on around the world. That's a whole different, you know, a can of worms.
It's the same. Yeah, absolutely. It's the same theme, a single day versus a single microenvironment. But I'll tell you one thing. I think we do a real disservice to people and to the argument by discounting those who don't believe in global warming as being lunatics or misguided in some way. You never convince people of something by calling them stupid or dismissing their opinions. What we should be saying is, all right, let's have a discussion based upon evidence. Here is the evidence for global warming. Here is the evidence against. And this is the quality of the evidence on either side. This many climate scientists, the vast, vast majority, agree based upon this evidence that the Earth is getting warmer and for human causes. A scant, you know, very few say otherwise based upon scant and very poor evidence. Has science been wrong in the past? Absolutely. Can we prove this to a certainty? No, we can't. But given what is at stake, and given the huge amount of data arguing one way, it seems foolish to discount all of it based upon single data points by extreme claims. And so, I mean, that's the real balance here. But people who criticize climate scientists because they say, well, they've become a religion, they won't listen to any voice to the contrary, that's just not true. They listen to the voices to the contrary, and they weigh them based upon the evidence they present, and the evidence just doesn't hold up.
And there's also something that every, you know, physics and chemistry student and biology student learns about in doing experiments is the concept of there are uncertainties in measurements. And when we take those into account when we collect our information, that your data and your information, you can only be as good as the tools that you're using and the accuracy of your measurements and the precision of those over time, your repeatability. But when the general public hears this word uncertainty, they draw a very different conclusion.
Absolutely true. You know, one of the greatest advances of modern science has been the development over the past several centuries of statistics as an extremely mature field. And what statistics really is, at least in the context of scientific research, is a way of quantifying uncertainty. How uncertain are you? How likely are you to make a mistake? And we have set criteria as a scientific field, most fields, to say, well, you'll never prove anything to an absolute certainty, but we're willing to be this uncertain. And that's the criteria that we use. And so it's a very codified thing. Now, there's downsides to that as well. But not appreciating uncertainty, and by the way, not appreciating what chance effects actually look like, it truly misguides people in a lot of ways. And this goes back to another thing where this is not common sense. This feels wrong. But the statistical analysis of it really gives power to telling how confident you are in a particular claim.
Let's take a short break. We're talking to James Imring. He is a professor of pathology and blood research at the University of Virginia and the author of the new book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. I'm Dave Sloom, and this is Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with James Imring as we talk about what science is and how it works, which also happens to be kind of the title of his new book. Tell me about when did you decide to embark on writing this book? Because it must have been, you know, a lot of work, because this is a really very rich book, and it must have taken a long time to write. So tell me about the process. When did you first decide? What was the genesis of this project where you decided, I'm gonna write a book about this?
You know, it was when I was teaching this course on scientific thinking, and my students started to say to me that they were frustrated because there was no central text that they felt spoke to them on this topic. That we were cobbling together articles that they were reading or essays that they were reading or excerpts from books, but there was no integrated kind of gestalt that could give them the view. And I thought, yeah, that'd be really useful to do. And then actually I wrote this book, you know, three or four times over, because there's no way to step into a bunch of knowledge that depends upon each other and explain it in an easy way. And I tried this way and I tried that way, and also educating myself along the way. But it started at Emory University, where I was teaching at the time, and continued at the University of Washington. And now I've recently moved to the University of Virginia. So it's been a long road. And yeah, it's been a great learning experience for me, because you never have to understand something better than when you try to explain it. And so it's been a lot of fun, but no small amount of pounding away on my keyboard.
Oh, I bet. And as you researched this and did your own journey of coming to your own understanding of how science really works, was there something that you had kind of an aha moment at one point that you could give us an example of, where your own understanding of your own misconceptions of how science works, where you kind of like, oh, wow, you know, I never really thought about it that way. Can you give us an example of that?
Oh gosh, there's so many, right? Because life is a journey of learning, and science is no different. But I think my biggest aha moment, if there's one philosopher of science that scientists have probably heard of, it's a gentleman named Karl Popper. And Karl Popper tried to make a distinction of science, is that he said that basically the ability to reject an idea, to rule something out, is a defining characteristic of science. He saw a lot of theory systems that would gather evidence to support themselves, but not that many that would seek evidence to reject the idea. And this is, Einstein is quoted as saying, it's actually kind of a paraphrase of what he really said, but the quote is that no amount of evidence can ever prove me right. A single experiment can prove me wrong. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think a lot of people point to and say, yes, that is the case. Now, it is true, true with a lowercase t, that logic can tell you how you may have misinterpreted the world in ways that it can't tell you how you might have gotten the world right. But my big aha moment was reading the work of some philosophers named Duhem and Quine, who pointed out that, well, not only can you never prove an idea, but actually you can't disprove it either. Which doesn't sound right. And, you know, Popper was aware of this, although he probably wasn't aware of how big of a problem it is. And the reason you can't disprove it is you can always rescue a hypothesis from rejection by evoking a different background belief. And we have all kinds of background assumptions all the time of which we're unaware. And my favorite example of this, because it's a great story, has to do with Newtonian mechanics. So when Isaac Newton made a few assumptions about the laws of motion and gravity and this and that, he came up with this amazing mathematical description of the motion and behavior of both terrestrial and celestial bodies. First celestial, then terrestrial. And the system had incredible predictive power and a number of great triumphs. When Halley's Comet was coming back and its circle was supposed to be 75 years, they predicted, well, this time around, it's going to be a year late because it's going to move close to these gravitational bodies. And they were spot on right. And they got all these things right, the astrophysicists did. But then they said, you know what? The orbit of Uranus is wrong. According to Newtonian mechanics, this isn't right. So from a Karl Popper point of view, well, the orbit of Uranus is wrong. You reject Newtonian mechanics, right? Then you can rule it out. It was just wrong, so it can't be a correct theory. But the theory had been so successful for so long, they said, maybe we're wrong about our background assumption of the number of planets there are. Maybe there's another planet out there that we hadn't discovered yet. And they calculated where it ought to be, and they pointed their telescope where that was, and bam, they found Neptune. So this is an incredible triumph because you know, the theory made a wrong prediction, but by changing a background assumption, the theory led to even a greater triumph. And then came what you're talking about, is that the Mercury's orbit was also perceived to be wrong. Actually, it wasn't the orbit of Mercury. It's what's called the perihelion precession, which is how the orbit of Mercury itself moves around the sun. And they said, well, obviously, there's just another planet out there, another one that we haven't observed, and they calculated where it ought to be, and they said, yep, we're going to call it Vulcan. We're very confident it should be between Mercury and the Sun, and they pointed their telescopes at it, and sure enough, they found Vulcan, and they reported it, and it was a great triumph that there was this extra planet. Now, to you and your listeners, I'm assuming most people didn't learn in school that our solar system is the Sun, Vulcan, Mercury, Venus, Earth. In fact, if anything, Vulcan is a very faraway planet that pointy-eared logicians come from. And so what happened in this case is that Vulcan was not there. To the best of our knowledge, it was never there, even though from time and again it was spotted. But these were mistakes in observation. As we talked about earlier, sometimes data is incorrect. These were incorrect data. And it wasn't until Einstein's relativity theory, which basically could explain Mercury's orbit because time-space warps around the large gravitational sun. And so here's an instance where you have a theory, and in one case, the data just doesn't line up with the theory, but instead of rejecting the theory, you can change your background belief and the theory still holds. And in an identical instance where the theory doesn't make a correct prediction, and so you change some background beliefs, but no matter what you do, you can't rescue the theory because, regrettably, the theory is just wrong. Newtonian mechanics is just wrong. It's not a special case of relativity. The way it talks about time and space and simultaneity is wrong. And so my aha moment was realizing this situation where no matter how much evidence you have, you can never prove a theory, but no matter how damning evidence is from a logical point of view, you can't rule out a theory because you can always evoke something else. Now, for a practical point of view, and this is a pragmatic science, at some point you have to say, well, this is the best of our understanding, and here's how it is. But time and again through the history of science, when things have gone off the rails, it's because the background assumptions were incorrect. Something new is discovered, or something that was thought to exist was shown not to.
Yes, and so far, the wonderful predictive power of Einstein's general theory of relativity, as witnessed with the recent detection of gravitational waves, for example, and the recent image of a black hole, you know, keeps showing that theory is our best understanding of how the universe works. But this leads me to my next question. And we, our friends in the lay public, they have a different understanding of what the word theory means, because you'll always hear them say, well, that's just a theory, as if it's, you know, Jessica Fletcher on Murder, She Wrote, trying to come up with her first idea of who murdered whom. But that's not what a scientific theory is. Could you give us, you know, your understanding of what a theory really is?
First of all, a scientific theory is an explanation. An accepted theory is a theory from which you can predict natural phenomenon that so far occur. And a theory may make many predictions, many spooky predictions, and by spooky, I mean things that people wouldn't otherwise think of, and be correct, just like Einstein's theory. Before Einstein came along, and he was kind of forced into relativity by trying to explain why light behaved the way it did. At the time, they thought there was this luminous ether that the light traveled through, but they couldn't detect an ether wind and other things. His theory made crazy predictions that light would bend around gravitational bodies, you know, that time was not fixed, that how heavy you were, your mass and your size could change, you know, relative to someone else depending on the speed you were moving. And this has been an incredibly successful theory because, you know, it is made all these predictions. But I should say to you, in my opinion, it's no more successful than Newtonian mechanics was. And it has no less of an appearance of truth than Newtonian mechanics did. So a theory that we consider to be true is simply an explanation that we have not yet rejected despite our best efforts to do so. But should a new phenomenon come along that the theory cannot handle, even with altering background assumptions in a reasonable way, then that theory has to be thrown out. So when people say, well, you know, evolution is just a theory, and, you know, therefore you shouldn't believe it, it's a theory with a huge amount of evidence to support it. It's not just a theory. I mean, certainly everybody has a right to their opinion, but not every opinion is grounded in the same amount of evidence. And that makes a big distinction. But if you have a theory that you are unwilling to consider could be wrong if the right observation were made, that's not science anymore. That's an absolute, unshakable belief, and that approaches faith. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with faith, but scientific theories are not faith-based. They're evidence-based, and all of them could be rejected if the right observation came along.
We've run against the time barrier here, but before I let you go, a last thought that occurred to me talking to you is that for all of its flaws, scientific thinking and the kind of reasoning that you explain in your book is really our best bet as a species to survive and thrive on this planet, because science really is, it's the best way to go to find the truth.
I would say science is the best way to describe and understand the workings of nature. The truth is a very loaded term, and it means a lot of different things to different people. And if you look at the history of natural philosophy, there was a time when science was trying to answer, you know, the big questions of why are humans here? What is our purpose? What is our existence? All these types of things. And I think we can set that aside. But if your goal is to predict and control nature, there is no system that comes even close to science. It is not perfect. It will make errors. But if you had a tool that worked most of the time and your other option was random guessing, which would you choose?
Yeah. Well, I'm not talking about the meaning of life there when I talk about seeking the truth. More like, you know, I'll leave that to Monty Python.
if the truth of which you speak is the earth getting warmer? Do vaccines cause autism? These types of issues, in that context of the truth, yeah. Now, of course, it's self-gratifying, I guess, to say it because I'm a professional scientist. But just as I say science stands on the evidence, I would make that claim stand on the evidence. If you look at the progress, technological progress and advances that science has made decade after decade, century after century, we can debate whether humans put those advances to good use or not, but nothing has performed as well as science. In fact, nothing even comes close.
Well, on that note, James Zimring, I'm going to let you go. And thank you very much for spending this time with us. It's been fascinating to talk to you about this wonderful book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. And best of luck to you in the future. And you're welcome back anytime. I could talk to you for hours about stuff like this.
It's really been a pleasure for me. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Dr. James Zimring from the University of Virginia, where he is a professor of pathology specializing in transfusion medicine and blood biology. His new book is What Science Is and How It Really Works. It's available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.